gunfire. Boom, boom. Then I heard something big fall to the ground. Well, either that's a giant fox, or that sucker has killed a pig, I said. We climbed out of our stand and walked toward him. He'd killed a 150-pound pig. You haven't gutted him? I asked. No, I was afraid I'd mess it up, he said. Boys, here's rule number one in hunting. If you're going to shoot something, you have to learn to clean it, I said. I gutted the hog in the woods and we carried it back to my Mitsubishi Montero. We drove to the landowner's house and knocked on the door. His wife answered and told us he wasn't there. He was at a guest house on the north side of town. When we found the owner, he couldn't believe we'd killed a pig on his property. Being in Germany, we had to discuss the hunt over a couple of pitchers of beer. The owner kept the hog, but he gave my buddy its teeth as a trophy. The landowners in Germany were very particular about what you could shoot on their property. They didn't like us shooting the biggest hogs. During one hunt, I noticed a hole that looked like a big horseshoe in the middle of tall brush. It was actually a trail where hogs had been running. A few minutes later, I heard dogs barking, and it was getting louder. The dogs were running toward me. All of a sudden, the big hole in the brush was gone. A hog stuck its head through and kept running right at me. I didn't think it was going to stop, so I grabbed my gun. The hog came within about 3 feet of me, but then it turned around and ran back into the hole. My sergeant major was with me and was yelling, "Can I shoot him? Can I shoot him?" "No, he's too big," I said. The hog probably weighed more than 300 pounds and had huge tusks sticking out of the sides of its snout. It was pretty, but it was too big to shoot. A few minutes later, guns started going off, and I saw a 40-pound hog running my way. I looked through the scope of my rifle and saw two big oak trees. If the hog ran between the trees, I thought I had one chance to shoot it, if someone else didn't get it first. When the hog hit my scope, I fired and the hog flipped in the air. The Germans blew their horns, signaling that the hunt was over. One of the Germans came down and asked everyone who shot it. About 5 guys claimed it, but I told him I was the last one to shoot when it fell. They gave the hog to my colonel, which was probably a good thing. It was always fun to see the spread after a German hunt. There was such a variety of game. There was usually an elk, 4 or 5 roe deer, 12 hogs, a couple of pheasants, and a bunch of rabbits. You have to understand that a German Hase isn't much smaller than a roe deer. They're the biggest rabbits I've ever seen. Whenever we went rabbit hunting, the Germans always warned us not to confuse a roe deer with a rabbit. But it was easy to do because they are so similar in size. The first time I went rabbit hunting, I was convinced they had bulletproof fur. The Germans liked to shoot over and under shotguns, and I watched 4 of them fire at the same rabbit. Every time one of them shot twice, I saw fur fly, but the rabbit kept running. As the rabbit got closer, I told myself the rabbit wasn't going to get by me. When it got close to me, the dogs were just about to catch it. The Germans were screaming, "Don't shoot the dog! Don't shoot the dog!" I fired my gun. Boom! It was a headshot, and the rabbit flipped. The dog was so close, it caught the rabbit in the air. I'm not sure what would have happened if I'd accidentally shot the German's dog. Those Germans love their dogs. I've never had much success with hunting dogs, except for standard poodles. But the Germans train their dogs meticulously. Sometimes when I walked into a restaurant in Germany, dogs would be sitting next to a table while their masters ate steaks. The dogs didn't move and didn't have an ounce of slobber on their mouths. That wouldn't happen in Louisiana. At Phil's house, Miss Kay's dogs usually eat steak before we do. One of the most ferocious dogs I've ever seen was in Germany, and it weighed only 10 pounds. It was only a puppy, but it had razor-sharp teeth. Before we went hunting one morning, a couple of dogs started fighting. The little dog had latched on to a German short-haired pointer's ear and wouldn't let go. I thought, man, that dog's tough. He's a buzzsaw with teeth. When the hunt started, dogs and pigs were running everywhere. All of a sudden, I saw a 200-pound hog running toward me. The pig kept shaking its head. The little dog had latched on to its ear and wouldn't let go. A couple of hours later, the little dog ripped the ears right off of a rabbit. It's a good thing rabbits have good eyesight from eating so many carrots. If that rabbit had needed glasses, it would have been in trouble.
I live by my own rules, reviewed, revised, and approved by my wife, but still my own rules.
Chapter 27 Semi-Retirement. I was stationed in Germany 3 times for a total of nearly 8 years while I served in the Army. During my last deployment to Germany, the Army informed me it didn't need me anymore. In 1992, Congress trimmed the military budget by more than $278 million, and I was part of the cuts. After serving for more than 24 years, Uncle Sam forced me into retirement on January 31, 1993. The Army told me to hit the road, Jack. Christine and I moved to Holly Tree, Alabama, which is located in the northern part of the state, not far from the Tennessee border. Christine and I really enjoyed living in the mountains in Germany, and the Appalachian Mountains in North Alabama were beautiful as well. We rented a house from an Army friend of mine for about a year, and then we bought a place of our own and lived there for 4 more years. Tracy was in college, but Scott was still living with us and attended high school in Alabama. Hey, you know what I didn't do after I retired from the military? I didn't shave. After shaving my face for more than 2 decades while I was in the Army, I threw away my razors, Jack. Phil already had a long beard, and most of the duck men who were hunting with him on a regular basis had long, thick beards. Facial hair helps hide your pale skin from ducks. You might as well be wearing spotlights if you get into a duck blind with a clean-shaven face. The ducks will see you from a mile away. I've learned over the last several years that a beard helps camouflage your face and keeps you warm during the winter. Hey, you want to talk about 50 Shades of Grey? I have an entire range of hues in my beard nowadays. Hey, it's tough being this good-looking. Our house in Alabama was located in the mountains, and our property actually had about 4 levels from where rock had busted through the earth. It was a great hunting ground. There was an abundance of game and so many places to hide. I could walk on an upper level of rock and look down and see everything. One day I was deer hunting and thought I heard a buck rubbing its antlers on a tree, but when I looked down, I saw about 40 turkeys. I crawled closer to get a better look, but the scout saw me and started chirping. The turkeys took off running. I never figured out where the turkeys came from or where they went. Turkeys also like to climb into a pine tree in my yard. 4 turkeys climbed the tree, with 1 facing east, 1 west, 1 north, and 1 south. The rest of the turkeys slept under the tree, while the 4 in the tree stood guard. We also had 2 giant pear trees about 10 yards from our house. One day, a doe with 2 fawns walked into our yard to eat pears that had fallen to the ground. The deer gorged themselves on the pears for about 30 minutes. Every time one of the deer moved, it farted. The deer ate so many pears it looked like their bodies were going to explode. Their bellies were so bloated. I'd never seen a deer with so much gas. Christine, Scott, and I sat on the front porch laughing at them. When the deer finally left, they sounded like a train leaving our yard. Now, I told you I don't like snakes, and I don't care if they're venomous or non-venomous. If you bring a snake close to me, you're going to get hurt. I had a garden in our backyard in Alabama that was surrounded by waist-high grass. One day I was out picking tomatoes, cucumbers, and peppers from our garden, and our wiener dog ran into the weeds. As soon as the dog yelped, I knew what had happened to it. A rattlesnake had bitten the dog. I took the dog inside our house, and I saw the fang marks while Christine was holding it. We took the dog to the vet, but he said he couldn't do anything because it was too much venom for such a little dog. The vet ended up putting our dog down. About 2 weeks later, I was driving back to our house and saw a bunch of people gathered around a barn by my driveway. I looked and I saw a big rattlesnake lying in the middle of the road. I drove my truck over the snake about 10 times. I put it in reverse, slammed on the brakes, and made sure the snake was as flat as a pancake. When it was dead, I saw that the snake had about 10 rattles and a button. It was huge. I knew it was the snake that killed my dog. One of my neighbors asked me if I wanted the rattles. "No, you can have them," I told him. My neighbor slit the snake open with a knife and then cut off its head. He cut off the rattles, put them in his pocket, and walked down the road. I told Scott about the snake when he got home from school. Of course, Scott wanted to see it, so I took him down by the road. When Scott stepped on the snake's body, it popped him even though its head had been cut off. There was a bloody mess all over his boot. "Good grief," Scott said. "Can you believe that?" "Yeah, I can believe it," I said. "That's the only thing that snake is designed to do, strike you." Several years later, Phil and I went back to his house after a fishing trip. He saw a copperhead sitting on the front steps and killed it with a hoe. Phil chopped the snake into about 10 pieces. Well, Jesse, who was Miss K's prized rat terrier dog, grabbed the snake's head and took off running. When the dog grabbed the snake's head, it struck him. The dog staggered off into the woods, and when it came back, its head was swollen like a basketball. Somehow, Jesse survived the snake bite. After I left the military, I wasn't really sure what I was going to do for the rest of my life. I was receiving a military pension, but I needed to find something to keep me busy. So I started working as a groundskeeper at a golf course near our house. Hey, there were snakes all over the golf course. One of the guys who worked with me killed a huge cottonmouth and was chasing everybody with it. When he started coming my way, I grabbed an iron stake. One of the other guys told him, "Hey, he will hurt you." "What are you talking about?" the guy asked. "Hey, he will wrap that iron stake around your head," the other guy said. "The snake is already dead," he said. "Hey, if you bring that snake any closer, you're going to be dead with him," I said. While I worked at the golf course, I nearly drove the superintendent slap insane because I kept asking him if I could fish for crappie in the ponds. "You can't fish on the course," he told me. "We have golfers out there." "Hey, I'm not going to bother the golfers," I said. "When they come up to the green, I'll walk away and they won't even see me." One day, the superintendent finally relented and let me fish in the ponds. I caught so many fish that I filled up the back of a golf cart cargo bed with bass and crappie. Some of the bass weighed between 5 and 7 pounds. I must have caught 30 crappie, and they weighed about 2 pounds each. The superintendent drove by me while I was fishing. "Good grief," he said. "Where did you catch all those fish?" "Duh," I said. "In the pond. It's a gold mine." After that day, the superintendent knew he wasn't going to keep me from fishing in the ponds. Before too long, I was also begging the superintendent to let me hunt deer on the golf course. Whenever we mowed the fairways, I kept seeing 8- and 10-point bucks. I chased the deer with my lawnmower all over the golf course. "Look, are you going to let me hunt deer out here?" I asked the superintendent. "No," he said. "You can't hunt deer out here. There are golfers all over the place. You'll shoot one of them. Hey, I'll be careful, I said. Did you look at the pond on the third hole this morning? There were 16 deer down there. This place is like the Graceland for whitetails. A few months after I quit working at the golf course, one of my buddies called me and told me he shot a 16-point buck on the 17th fairway. They're letting you hunt out there now? I asked him. Yep, as soon as you left, he said. I could have filled up 7 freezers with venison. I worked at the golf course for about a year, and then one of my buddies and I left to go work for Hewlett Packard in Huntsville, Alabama. I worked in the warehouse and backed the trucks up so we could load them with computers. I worked there for about a year until they started talking about layoffs. Then I went to work with my neighbor who owned a home repair business. We remodeled houses, built decks and barns, and completed other construction projects. It was good work, but I wasn't sure I wanted to be doing manual labor for the rest of my life. One day in the winter of 1999, I called Phil to see if they were killing any ducks in Louisiana. Hey, when you going to come to work for me, he said. This duck commander thing is really starting to take off. No, Christine told me she doesn't want to live in Louisiana, I said. I don't think it's going to work. Suit yourself, Phil said. Building duck calls is a heck of a lot more fun than repairing roofs. Phil wasn't kidding.
I'm so dope, I'm illegal in 55 states.
Chapter 28. Homecoming. Remember when I told you Christine said she would never live in Louisiana again? When we were living in Alabama, I came home from work one day and she stopped me in my tracks. You know what I think we should do? She said. If we can sell our house, we should move back to Louisiana so you can be closer to your brothers and sisters. Are you sick? I asked her. Hey, I thought Christine was terminally ill. My children and I really thought she was going to die. After we left Fort Polk near Leesville, Louisiana, she told me she would never live in the state again, no matter what. I didn't think there was any way she would ever move back to Louisiana, but she knew how much returning home meant to me. I called Tracy to tell her the news about our moving. Mama's dying, isn't she? She asked. I think so, I said. Christine was actually fine, but she was willing to make a sacrifice so I would be happy. I was ready to start working for Duck Commander, and Phil's business was really starting to prosper. Every time I went back to Louisiana to go hunting with Phil, he was always trying to get me to work for him. I knew Phil needed some help, and I figured helping him build duck calls would be a heck of a lot better than what I was doing for a living at the time. Christine had been working for the U.S. Department of Defense for about 10 years, and she was working about 10 hours a day and 6 days a week. We didn't have much of a life outside of work, which was really what we'd been doing our entire lives. Christine was getting ready to retire and needed a break. Well, God must have been watching over us again. After Christine and I seriously talked about moving to Louisiana, we agreed to call a real estate agent the next Monday and advertise our house in the newspaper. Hey, we never even had to put our house on the market. We talked about it on a Friday and Saturday and went to church on Sunday morning. We told some of the people in our congregation that we were going to move to Louisiana if we could sell our house. One of the women in our church overheard us talking and her eyes immediately lit up. Hey, you want to sell your house? She said. My daughter wants to buy it. That's her dream house. We found out later that we had actually outbid her daughter for the house when we'd purchased it a few years earlier. I came up with a sale price that would pretty much allow us to break even or make a little bit of cash, and the lady's daughter agreed to buy it a couple days later. There was no negotiating or haggling over the price, probably because there weren't any real estate agents involved. I probably could have asked for more money, but I was ready to move to Louisiana. Hey, as soon as the girl signed a contract to buy my house, I packed my bags and jumped in my truck. Okay, baby, I'll see you later, I told Christine. You can find me at Phil's house. I drove straight to West Monroe and started working for Phil the next day. Well, we actually hunted and fished for a few days, but Christine doesn't need to know that. I left her behind to pack up the house and handle the details. She wasn't too happy about my leaving, but she was used to doing it, since we moved so many times while I was in the military. A few weeks later, Christine called me and said I had to come back to Alabama to sign the closing papers for our house. "You can't do it without me?" I asked. "No, honey, legally you have to be physically present to sign it," she said. We moved to West Monroe and bought a house a few miles down the road from Miss Kay and Phil. From day one, I was the reed man at Duck Commander, which is what Phil wanted me to do. He said I made reeds better than anyone else, because nobody else took the time to do them right. Whenever Jace, Willie, Jip, or someone else built reeds, you could never build a duck call quickly because you were always fixing the reeds. When I built the reeds, if you looked at 100 of them, they all looked the same. They were uniform. I figured out exactly how short to cut the reeds and determined that the top reed has to be just a little bit shorter than the bottom one for the calls to sound right. After I bend two reeds and put a dimple and rivet in them so they'll stick together, you don't even have to blow the calls to make sure they sound right. Of course, Jace, Godwin, Jep, Martin, me, and other Duck Commander's employees blow every duck call to make sure it sounds like an actual duck. I don't know how many reeds I've built over the years. At one point, I'd made 400,000 reeds, which were put into 200,000 duck calls. We only have one duck call that doesn't use reeds. Of course, I didn't realize what I was getting into when I took a job with Duck Commander. I figured I'd build duck calls for a few years and hunt and fish on most days. But when Willie bought the company from Phil, he had much bigger dreams for it. I had no idea Hollywood and cable TV were part of his plans. Phil had been making hunting videos for several years, and eventually I had a regular role in them. At first, whenever they pointed the cameras at me, I told them, "Hey, y'all don't have to film me, film somebody else." I really didn't want to be on the video. I was only out there to hunt and shoot ducks. But then they started filming me on the sly, and I never saw them doing it. Jace or Willie would do something in the blind to make me angry, or I'd start telling them a story from Vietnam, and I wouldn't even know that they were filming me. Well, the people who were buying our hunting DVDs loved hearing my stories. They started calling and writing to Duck Commander, telling us they wanted to hear more Uncle Si stories. When we went to Outdoor Channel and then A&E TV, I didn't even know how big of a role I was going to have in our shows. Willie asked me if I wanted to be involved, and I told him, "Hey, whatever y'all want me to do." Well, when A&E launched Duck Dynasty, I was only supposed to appear in the show occasionally. After we filmed two or three episodes of Duck Dynasty, they showed them to a focus group in Los Angeles. For whatever reason, the people loved watching me. They said I was the star of the show and I wasn't even supposed to be in it. I'm not sure why I struck a nerve with so many people, but I could have never imagined people's reaction to me. Duck Dynasty had really changed my life. It's hard to go anywhere now without being stopped for a photograph or autograph. I'm happy to do it, but nowadays it takes a lot longer to go to the gas station or grocery store. I'll do almost anything a kid asks me to do, and I know our show wouldn't be where it is today without our fans. It's amazing how many people send me free stuff at the Duck Commander warehouse. A car dealer in Arkansas even gave me a free truck to drive. The dealer put his name on the doors, and they asked me if I wanted anything else on it. I told them to put "Hey, Jack" in the back window and "The Duck Man" on the tailgate. Wouldn't you know it? I worked my entire life and never had a new truck, and now someone is giving me a free truck to drive when I'm retired. Hey, only in America.
One time I stopped and smelled the roses, and a big bumblebee went and stung me on the nose. So hey, from then on, look here, you smell the roses, but you smell them quick.
Chapter 29. Broken Heart. I started smoking cigarettes when I was in high school. Hey, back then, nobody really knew that smoking was bad for you. Both of my parents smoked, and so did most of my friends' parents. All of the Hollywood actors of the 1960s smoked, whether it was Steve McQueen, Burt Lancaster, Paul Newman, or James Coburn. Hey, if those guys were smoking cigarettes, I figured it had to be cool. And hey, there wasn't anyone cooler in Dixie, Louisiana than Silas Merritt Robertson. Well, I eventually figured out that a cigarette is nothing more than a pinch of tobacco rolled in paper, with fire at one end and an idiot at the other. Hey, what's the result of too much smoking? Coughing, Jack. I smoked for more than 30 years. It was hard to quit while I was in the military because the Army gave you 4 cigarettes with every meal. When they stopped giving them to us, I just bought them myself. I tried to quit many times over the years. I even used tobacco alternatives like water vapor cigarettes and electronic cigarettes. Hey, they never warned me that I could electrocute myself when I smoked them together. You want to talk about a high? Good grief! I smoked cigarettes in Vietnam to occupy my time more than anything else. One night, a sergeant ordered a buddy and me to deliver supplies to a camp on the other side of a jungle. It was a dangerous mission, which was made even worse by a driving rainstorm. As we made our way down a dark road, I heard a tap on the passenger side window of our Jeep. Hey, there's somebody knocking on my window, I told my buddy. Well, open it and see what he wants, he said. I rolled down the window. A Vietnamese man was staring at me. I didn't know if he was a civilian or with the Viet Cong. Do you have a cigarette? He asked. Hey, he wants a cigarette, I said. What do I do? Give him a cigarette and let's get out of here, my buddy said. I handed the man a cigarette and rolled up the window. Step on it, I said. I was a little freaked out by the incident, so I lit up a cigarette of my own. Now, we were really in a hurry to finish the mission, and I figured we were probably driving 60 miles per hour through the jungle. Then I heard another knock on my window. Good grief, I said. He's knocking on my window again. Well, see what he wants, my buddy said. I rolled down the window again. Do you have a light? The Vietnamese man said. Light his cigarette, my buddy said. Make it quick. I lit the man's cigarette, and my buddy put the Jeep's gas pedal to the floor. We were probably going 90 miles per hour now. Then I heard a knock on my window again. What in the world? I screamed. He's back. How is he doing it? I rolled down the window again, expecting him to shoot me. What do you want? I asked. Hey, would you like some help getting out of the mud? He said. After I left Vietnam and quit drinking alcohol, I figured smoking wasn't the worst vice for me. I never really noticed the toll smoking was taking on my body. Even though I was smoking Winston cigarettes, I was still able to complete the mandatory training runs and any other kind of physical activity the Army required of me. I even smoked when I played high school football, although the coaches probably would have killed me if they'd ever found out. I didn't realize secondhand smoke was bad for you until I went deer hunting when I was in my 40s. I was hunting on a friend's property in Germany, and he walked me to a deer stand at the start of the hunt. I climbed into the stand and lit a cigarette. A few seconds later, I heard someone coughing. I looked around for my buddy, figuring he'd come back to tell me something. But then I looked down and saw a spiked buck standing next to the tree. It was coughing from the cigarette smoke. Who knew secondhand smoke was even bad for deer? Well, eventually the cigarettes caught up with me. Near the beginning of January 2005, I knew something was wrong with my health. I was eating antacids constantly, even though my stomach was never upset by anything I ate. Growing up in Louisiana, everything we ate was spicy. I put hot sauce and pepper sauce on nearly everything, even my Fruity Pebbles. I had a cast iron stomach. When I started feeling ill, I thought I was having heartburn or acid reflux, but the antacids weren't helping. Christine kept telling me I needed to go see the doctor, but duck season was almost over, so I wanted to keep hunting. I kept putting off a doctor's visit. Christine knew I absolutely hated going to the doctor or visiting a hospital. Whenever Christine had surgery over the years, I tried to visit her, but she knew how anxious it made me. She always sent me home because I made her nervous. I visited her as soon as the surgery was over, and then I went back to get her when she was released. I figured it was the least I could do for her. It's not that I hate visiting doctors or going to the hospital. It's really more of a deeply rooted phobia. When we were kids, a mobile doctor's clinic visited the rural areas of Louisiana. Mama always took us to the clinic to get tetanus shots and other vaccinations we needed for school. Well, the first time Mama took me, I took off running through a cornfield. I don't like needles, and I don't like shots, Jack. Well, on the next to last day of duck season in 2005, we were sitting in a blind and killed about 4 or 5 ducks. Jace noticed a big flock of ducks flying to another part of Phil's land. They decided to pick up a few decoys and move to the other spot. "Hey, y'all go ahead," I said. "I ain't feeling too good. I'm going to sit here and see if I can get me a couple more ducks. Y'all come back when you're done hunting." After they left, I saw a mallard drake and mallard hen fly into the woods. I decided I was going to slip into the woods and whack 'em. I killed the mallard drake and retrieved it, but then my chest started hurting as I walked back to the blind. Suddenly, I was overcome with severe chest pains. I sat on a log and tried to catch my breath. When the pain finally abated, I walked back to my truck and drove home. I went straight to bed. I was absolutely exhausted and slept all day. Throughout the night, Christine kept checking on me to make sure I was still breathing. She feared something was seriously wrong with me. I got up at 4 o'clock the next morning to go duck hunting again. When I leaned over to put on my boots, the pain in my chest took my breath away. I woke up Christine and told her I needed to go to the emergency room. She knew something was very wrong. After the nurses checked my vital signs, they admitted me to the hospital. The doctor sent a camera scope down my throat to look at my heart. They told me I was having a heart attack and needed open-heart surgery. "Hey, I told you I was a heartbreaker." "Are you sure I need it?" I asked the surgeon. "Yeah, you need it," he said. "You'll die if you don't." "Well, I've been healthy all of my life," I said. "If you say I need it, then I guess I need it." Since it was a Saturday, the heart surgeon decided to wait to do my surgery until his regular team was on duty on Monday. I kept having heart attacks, but the doctors and nurses were monitoring me around the clock. They took really good care of me. On Monday, I had open heart surgery. When the surgery was over, doctors told Christine that overall I was pretty healthy. They took a vein from my leg and used it to bypass a blockage and get blood to my heart. After I woke up, the surgeon told me it was a privilege to operate on me because he didn't have to do any work to find my heart. When the surgeon cracked me open, he couldn't find an ounce of fat. My heart was sitting right there. They didn't even have to put me on a heart-lung machine to pump my blood during surgery. The surgeons repaired my heart between beats. I knew I was lucky to be alive. The surgeon told Christine I had what they called a widowmaker. My left main coronary artery was almost completely blocked. Medically, the doctors told me I should have died. A widowmaker can kill you within a matter of only 10 to 20 minutes. It was another of God's miracles. Thankfully, the Lord was watching over me again and sent me to good doctors, nurses, and surgeons who saved my life. My recovery from surgery was pretty rapid. It was around the time I usually helped Phil work on his land, which I really enjoyed doing. I liked being out in nature and loved spending time with my brother. I paced myself for 6 weeks, and when I received the all clear from the doctors, I went back to my normal routine. I had shortness of breath and got tired easily for a while, but before too long, I was back to being regular old Uncle Si. After my heart attack, I never picked up another cigarette. I promised Christine, my children, and my brothers and sisters that I would never smoke again, and I haven't. My heart attack really woke me up, and now I cherish every day I'm on this earth. Before my heart attack, I hadn't been to the doctor since 1993. Now I get a checkup every 6 months. Sunrises and sunsets are a lot more beautiful now, and I even take time to smell the roses. Hey, I still smell 'em quick, because you never know when a bumblebee might sting you on the nose.
Never insult a man's beard. You get either thunder or lightning. Hey, it's me, Cy again. Chapter 30, Faith. Hey, I don't use the term religious. A lot of people say they're religious, but then you watch how they act or listen to how they talk. Their action and language say otherwise. I don't really care about the names on the front of a church building, either, because I don't believe in denominations. You're either a Christian or you're not. My faith is pretty simple. I believe that God is the Father and His Son is Jesus Christ. I believe Jesus Christ came to this earth and became flesh for us because we have two problems. We have a sin problem and a death problem. And hey, we can't solve either one of them. Jesus left our Father's side, came to this earth as flesh, and died on a cross for the things Silas Robertson does wrong. I deserve to be on a cross and would be guilty as charged for some of the things I've done in my life. Jesus was innocent of all charges and did not belong there, yet he willingly went there and accepted my punishment. Hey, that's not the end of the story. A little girl watched her mother kill her father. The little girl went to church with her grandmother, and a Sunday school teacher showed her a picture of Jesus on the cross. Does anyone know who this is? The teacher asked. I don't know his name, the little girl said, but he didn't stay on the cross. What are you talking about? The teacher asked. I know he didn't stay on the cross because the night my mother killed my father, he was holding me in his arms, the little girl said. Jesus Christ dying on the cross wasn't the end of the story. They took his body down from the cross and buried him in a tomb. Before Jesus was crucified, he told everyone that if they ruined the temple, they thought he was referring to a religious temple, but he was actually talking about his body. He would raise it in 3 days, 3 days after they hung Jesus on the cross and killed him. He fulfilled what he said. He rose from the dead and spent 40 days and 40 nights with 500 people to prove his resurrection. Some people even watched his body ascend into the heavens. It was all part of God's plan. Jesus came to earth of his free will and knew what he had to do. He paid for my sins and then ascended into the heavens. Right now, Jesus is sitting next to our Heavenly Father. When I mess up, I say, Lord, I'm sorry. I've sinned again because I'm weak. They look down on me and Jesus turns to the Father and says, remember the cross. I have him covered. Hey, my faith is what my mama and daddy raised me to believe. I watched them live it. They didn't only talk the talk, but they walked the walk that matched the talk. When people ask me where I go to church, I tell them I'm a follower of Jesus Christ. I'm a Christian. I believe that he is who he said he was. Jesus said he was God's son, and I believe him. I believe he died on the cross for me. I believe he beat the grave, and that's a promise he's given me. He said, if you trust me, even if you die, you shall live. Hey, if anyone has a better offer for me, in which my sins will be forgiven and I can beat the grave, I'm willing to listen, but I don't think I'll ever hear a better offer for everlasting life. It's what I live by, and it's the great hope the Bible gives us. As Jace likes to say, the Bible is a love letter from God to mankind. In the Bible, God tells us how much he loves us and that he sent his son to die for us. Some people have asked how Jesus was able to live on this earth and not sin. Some people claim Jesus really wasn't a man. Hey, Jesus was a man. He proved it to the apostle Thomas, who doubted Jesus was resurrected until he could see and feel the wounds Jesus received on the cross, as it says in John 20:24-29. Now Thomas, also known as Didymus, one of the 12, was not with the disciples when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, we have seen the Lord. But he said unto them, unless I see the nail marks in his hand, and put my finger where the nails were, and put my hand into his side, I will not believe. A week later his disciples were in the house again, and Thomas was with them. Though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, peace be with you. Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here. See my hands. Reach out your hand and put it into my side. Stop doubting and believe." Thomas said to him, "My Lord and my God." Then Jesus told him, "Because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." Thomas believed Jesus was the Father's Son because he could touch and feel his wounds. Jesus was flesh and blood, but he was also deity. If he wasn't, he couldn't help me because he wouldn't be able to understand. Jesus died on the cross because he loved perfectly. When Jesus was in excruciating pain and was dying on the cross, he told the Father, "Forgive them. They don't know what they're doing." There isn't a more painful way for a human to die than being crucified on a cross. But Jesus still forgave those who killed him. Hey, if you're a Christian, racism is out. God made mankind from dust, and then he made woman. We don't even know what color Adam was. When I was growing up in Dixie, Louisiana, there were probably only 6 or 7 white kids in the entire town. Most of my friends were African American. If I had chores to do, I'd get my friends to help me paint a fence, clean the barn, or cut the grass. Then I'd take them to the water hole and teach them how to swim. I probably taught 20 African American kids how to swim. When Daddy fell from an oil rig and broke his back, we didn't have very much money because he wasn't working. Mama told some of the ladies in the neighborhood that we weren't going to have a Christmas that year because she didn't have any money to buy us presents. Well, the black families in town took up a donation and raised about $200 for us. We had a memorable Christmas because of their generosity, and nobody even asked them to do it. The Bible tells us to love everyone, regardless of race or religion. Hey, I believe in Jesus Christ, and he is God's Son. He came to this earth as flesh and died on a cross for our sins. He loved us enough to die for us, even his enemies. That's a fact, Jack.
Afterward, letters to Si from his family. A letter to Si from his wife, Christine. "When I first met you, I knew you as Rob. In the military, names were usually shortened, and the first name was never used. We had been together 16 months when I was introduced to your siblings, their children, and your parents. They called you Si, not Rob, so I did the same when we were with your family. But when we were alone, it was back to Rob. But after you became a household name, I decided I might as well join the crowd. When I met your family that first time, I wanted to run in the opposite direction. You know how shy I am and that I don't open up to people easily. It has always surprised me that you and I were able to talk as easily as we did from the very beginning. You wanted to live near Phil, so we stayed with Phil, Kay, and Alan, until we found an apartment not far from them. I understood that you had missed the hunting and fishing with Phil, but every time you went out with him, I worried. He was drinking by then, and I didn't trust him. After about a year, you realized he was beyond your help, and we moved to Ruston, Louisiana. I knew how that hurt your heart, but I was concerned about you. When you re-enlisted in the Army, I thought it was a great idea. Even though you are strong and stubborn, I worried about Phil rubbing off on you. Do you remember the first year you were able to duck hunt in 1971? You and Phil had killed 8, but when you cleaned them, there were only 7. Jason was now 3. When he came out of the bedroom the next morning, he had the duck under his arm. Evidently, he had slept with it. Phil said, 'There is a duck hunter in the making.' Look at Jason now. Alan, at such a young age, told everyone he would be a minister when he grew up. And that's exactly what he did. When we couldn't have children, you had so much faith. In my heart, I never believed I was worthy of children. But when I became pregnant, I knew it was a special gift from God. I was only sick twice, and everything went fine. When my contractions started and were coming every 15 minutes, you took me to the clinic. After the exam, they told you to get me straight to the hospital. It usually takes 40 minutes. You got me there in 20. All the way there, you kept me laughing. When we were waiting for a nurse to open the door, I was still laughing. When she opened the door, she said we didn't belong there. Both of us were shocked. She finally said, "No one who rings this bell is laughing." This was in the time before ultrasounds, so I had to have an x-ray. I ended up having an emergency C-section. You were there when I woke, but the only question you were able to answer was, "What was the sex?" I wanted to know how much she weighed, how long she was, and what color her hair was. You are such an observant person. Not. Tracy was born on Saturday night, but you were in the midst of a huge inspection, so you had to return to base. I'm a military wife, and I understood that spouses have to do some things alone. You were allowed to return to the hospital to sign some papers. Then you had to return to base. Tracy and I were discharged on Friday, but you were not allowed to come get us. Our home was always full of love and laughter, but with the addition of our beautiful daughter, it was even more so. Mom had always told me to be careful how I worded prayer. When we prayed for patience, we had no idea how God would answer. You always say that God has a sense of humor. We sure learned patience when we had our son. Due to complications in my pregnancy with Scott, our family was split up. Tracy was sent to my parents in Kentucky, you were at Fort Polk, and I was in Texas. We had so many people praying for us from three different states. In our time together, we have seen God's work in so many ways. Before I knew you, my dad was the only man I loved and respected. Girls often marry men like their dads. God was first in Dad's life. He also loved Mom and didn't care who knew it. I have been so blessed by having you in my life. Because of you, I have reached the brass ring. Life with you has never been boring or mundane. May God continue to keep you in the palm of His hand. I love everything about you and would never change anything. I'm also proud that you are now sharing your laughter and love of God with many, many people. You are awesome. A letter to Si from his daughter, Tracy. When I think of you, the first word that springs to mind is faith. You have always been so committed to God and the church, and that definitely rubbed off on me. The years of attending church three times weekly never seemed a burden, because you made sure we knew it was the right thing to do. I learned scripture first by hearing it from you and then by reading it on my own. I learned so much from God's Word. I used to wake up early some mornings and memorize pieces like the Sermon on the Mount so I could be an educated Christian. That habit has continued into my adult life, and I often turn to the Bible in times of trouble and of thanksgiving. That basis, that rock, which you gave me during my childhood, has led me to be the strong Christian woman I am today. The second word about you that wells up is nature. You love the outdoors and all the natural gifts the world has to offer. Because of your family's background, hunting and fishing are like breathing to you. But many were the times that we would sit together and you would point out the wildlife all around us. A bunny rabbit there, here a hawk with talons extended to catch a meal, sometimes a deer as its eyes reflected green in the passing headlights. I enjoyed those times immensely as you shared your wisdom about nature. Of course, I couldn't forget to thank you for my great love of food. As anyone who knows me will attest, I am an eater. And I'm not one of those dainty, waifish girls either, despite my history of modeling. On our first official date, when my future husband Kyle asked me if he could cook me dinner, he asked what I'd like. He expected me to say, "Oh, a salad, or whatever you'd like to make." Instead, I definitively stated, "I'd love a steak and a baked potato." That part of me surely comes straight from you, as well as my love for all kinds of meats. Yep, I'm quite the carnivore. As I told a friend recently, squirrel is still the best meat I've ever eaten, but the steak and critters are just too small. It takes a dozen just to feed two people. Seriously, though, a lot of my political perceptions were formed at your knee. I still believe in gun rights for hunters, and also for constitutional guarantees against governmental recklessness. I believe that people are more important than things or animals. And I believe that the right to life is sacred from conception to natural death. Thank you for helping form me into the person I've become. I am a physically confident, emotionally mature, intellectually gifted human being, and am so blessed by God in this life with my adoring husband and beautiful sons. I could not be happier in my life. I love you, Dad. A letter to Si from his son, Scott. When I think back to my childhood, I have so many memories. I remember watching you and Tracy clean squirrels and helping y'all once I got big enough. I remember you dressing up in costumes like the big rabbit. I remember you taking me deer hunting with you in Germany. I must have driven you crazy that day with all my fidgeting. You so wanted me to get a deer and maybe share that experience of your childhood. I simply loved the fact that I got to spend a day with my dad. I watched you and listened to you more than you knew. I picked up your love of the land and being in the woods simply from watching how you moved in the different trees you pointed out. I remember when you took me along on the wild boar hunt in Germany. I found out later I was going to be a beater and not with you. So there I was, crawling around this thick brush on the side of a mountain, making a lot of noise, which I have to say I enjoyed, to drive the animal toward the hunters. The gentleman with me had a pistol, which got me thinking, what happens if the boar doesn't beat it like he's supposed to? The gentleman with the pistol said I shouldn't worry about that, as it's very rare that the boars come at the beaters. I have to say I was not very reassured. When we finally got to stand up, I was relieved, only to find that after walking a short distance, we had to do it again at a different location. I remember you taking me with you for your duck hunting vacation in Louisiana when I was in the 5th grade, and fishing at night with cane poles and a lantern on the Ouachita River. I remember when we took a family trip to Bavaria, and Mom and Tracy got lost. You remained quite calm, in spite of all my questions of what if. I remember you reviewing the short sermon that I gave at the church we attended in Pyrmisons and helping me get over my first-time jitters. I look back at the conversations we had when I was a hard-headed teenager. I remember the heated discussions we had where you were just trying to steer me in the right direction, maybe away from mistakes you made. I remember that you wanted me to go to college and I wanted to join the military. I thought I had my points all lined up for the discussion and that you would understand. Needless to say, the conversation didn't quite go as I'd planned, and we agreed to disagree. I can't describe to you how I felt when I came back from AIT as a soldier, and you told me that I had made the right choice. I remember you telling me that the only things I can control, something I came into this world with and will leave with, is the value of my word. Dad, there are so many things I remember, and you are threaded through them all. I remember you telling me how much smarter your father got as you got older. I have to say, I never thought you didn't know what you were talking about. Though I can't say I understood as a child what I understand now as a parent myself. I look back to your words then and find myself applying them now when I hit a bump in the road of life. I have to say, I am amazed at the level of patience you possessed then and now. I consider myself blessed that I had the parents I did. No one is perfect, but y'all are the perfect ones for me. You are, and always have been, the rock this family holds to. Your faith in God as I grew up showed me that we might not always have the answers, and that was okay, because God was in charge and would always take care of us. I love you, Dad, and will consider myself lucky if I grew up to be half the man you are. Blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, or stand in the way of the sinners, or sit in the seat of mockers. But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law he meditates day and night. He is like a tree planted by streams of water, which yields its fruit in season, and whose leaf does not wither. Whatever he does prospers. Psalms 1, 1 through 3.
Psychology 1, Tales and Wisdom from Duck Dynasty's Favorite Uncle, was written by Cy Robertson with Mark Schlabach and read by Jay Stone with Cy Robertson. It was recorded at Music City Studios in West Monroe, Louisiana, and engineered by Scott Frick. Editing and post-production by Kessler Media Productions in Katona, New York. The mix and mastering engineer was Ryan Clark. The associate producer was Joanna Solitara. Psychology 1, Tales and Wisdom from Duck Dynasty's Favorite Uncle, was produced and directed by Robert Kessler. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Psychology 1, Tales and Wisdom from Duck Dynasty's Favorite Uncle, is available in hardcover from Howard Books. Also from Simon & Schuster Audio, Happy, 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 My Life and Legacy as the Duck Commander by Phil Robertson. Read by Al Robertson and introduced by the author.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.